Hey, good evening, everyone, and a very warm welcome to you all. My name is Max, and I'm one of the speaker secretaries here at the Cambridge University Law Society. And thank you very much for joining us this evening. This is the second speakers event we've been delighted to host this Lent term, and it's a real pleasure to see so many of you turning out here tonight. Events like this are very much at the heart of what the Law Society aims to do. And they continue a long-standing tradition dating back to 1921 of inviting leading figures from across the legal profession and judiciary to Cambridge to speak with our members. Part of that aim is to demystify the legal profession, to move beyond the black letter law of our textbooks, and to hear directly from the people behind the cases, judgments, and principles we spend so much time studying. We hope events like this give a clearer sense of what a life in the law can look like, and perhaps offer some inspiration as our members begin to chart their own paths. It is a particular honour this evening to welcome Lord Richards. We are extremely grateful to him for spending the time and taking the time to join us and speak tonight, and especially pleased to be welcoming him back to Cambridge, where he studied law at Trinity College, graduating in 1973. Much has no doubt changed since then, both in the law and in Cambridge itself, but I suspect some traditions and perhaps a few enduring library habits remain reassuringly familiar. This evening, Lord Richards will reflect on his career in the law and the path that led him to the Supreme Court, discuss a number of significant and at times controversial cases he has worked on, and share his views on some topical issues facing the courts today. Subject to time, we'll also aim to leave space at the end for a Q&A session. Before we begin, it's now my pleasure to hand over to our president, G1, who will formally introduce our speaker this evening.
Thank you, Max, for the introduction. We are very honoured and privileged to have Lord Richards to speak with us today. I will now share more about his career leading up to his appointment as a Supreme Court Justice. Sir David Anthony Stuart Richards, Lord Richards of Camberwell, became a Justice of the Supreme Court on the 3rd of October 2022. He studied law at Trinity College, Cambridge, and he was called to the bar in 1974 and took silk in 1992. Whilst at the bar, Sir David's principal area of practice was company law and corporate insolvency. His highest expertise in these areas has been prominent over his judicial career. Lord Richards was appointed as a Deputy High Court Judge in 2001 and selected for the Chancery Division in 2003. He was then appointed a Chairman of the Competition Appeal Tribunal in 2004 and Chairman of the Insolvency Rules Committee from 2005 to 2015. He was the Chancery Supervising Judge for the Northern and Northeastern Circuits and Vice-Chancellor of the County Palatine of Lancaster from 2008 to 2011. Lord Richards was appointed as a Lord Justice of Appeal and made a Privy Councillor in 2015. He retired from the Court of Appeal in June 2021. Thereafter, he practiced as an arbitrator and legal expert, as well as continuing to sit in the Court of Appeal on a part-time basis. He also sat in appeals to the Privy Council. He was elected a bencher of Lincoln's Inn in 2000 and treasurer of the Inn for 2020 to 2021. He has also served as chairman of the Lincoln's Inn Finance and General Purposes Committee. He was a director of the International Insolvency Institute from 2015 to 2019 and co-chair of its Judicial Committee until 2019. We are incredibly grateful to Lord Richards for travelling down to speak to our members today. In particular, in light of his upcoming retirement from the Supreme Court and Privy Council this June, we wish to mark this occasion as a celebration of his contributions to the UK's legal landscape over a career spanning 52 years. Please put your hands together to warmly welcome Lord Richards.
Well, thank you very much indeed for that welcome, and thank you all for turning out on a not very pleasant winter's afternoon. It's very good indeed to be here. As you've just heard, I read law here well over 50 years ago, between 1970 and 73. And as Max observed, much has no doubt changed in that time. In one sense, that is undoubtedly true, because this building didn't exist when I read law. The law faculty was in a building called the Old Schools, which is right in the centre of town, at right angles to the Senate House. The Squire Law Library is now the Caius College Library, and you now are here in these magnificent surroundings. I quite liked it in the old schools, not only because it was very close to Trinity and so was could get to a 9 o'clock lecture pretty quickly, but also because I felt as a lawyer it was good to be in the centre of town. But having seen this place on a number of occasions, I can certainly see the advantages of it. I think one thing that hasn't changed really is the core of the syllabus for law, reading law at Cambridge. It's not a curious thing, but it can be observed about the law that it is this constant accretion of building blocks, literally over the centuries. So that we, you and we, look at cases which may have been decided 100 or 200 years ago, perhaps not often 200 years ago, but occasionally. I have myself once or twice in judgment cited judgments of Lord Mansfield rendered in the 1780s and 90s, which remain good law today. But it's that fact that you've got this continuing core of law, which is being added to and subtracted from over the centuries, but which remains at the heart of our studies. So I will be touching on some subjects this evening, which have developed, but are the core of them is fundamentally the same now as it was when I read law and for many years before that. So I feel we're able to talk to each other, if you like, about the subject that you're reading. And I have devoted my working career too. I'm very glad I did read law. I would have very much liked to have read history, and maybe I should have done part one history and a 2-year part two law, which might have been a good way of doing it. But truth to tell, I didn't really want to spend 4 years in Cambridge. I actually only wanted to spend 3 years in Cambridge. So in those circumstances, I did the 3 years law. I'm glad I did, because I think it does give you a very good grasp of the building blocks of law. And I think I have found that constantly helpful throughout my career. Now, that's not to say if you read another subject and then switch to law, that you won't acquire the same building blocks. But you'll be doing it in a slightly piecemeal way as you go along in your career. Whereas if you've read law, they're there for you, and I have found it a real aid to my understanding of the law. I was fortunate, as you are, to have extremely good lecturers and supervisors. I might just mention two or three, four. Glanville Williams, I don't know if that's a name that's still familiar, but in the criminal law, he was one of my two criminal law lecturers. He was a fellow of Jesus, so I wasn't supervised by him. He was an extremely good lecturer, and the clarity of his thought was absolutely outstanding. Gareth Jones not only lectured me, but was my tutor, my director of studies in my third year, and also a supervisor. He, of course, was one of the two authors of Gough and Jones on restitution, as it was then called. I think it's now called On the Law of Unjust Enrichment. But he was one of the progenitors of the English analysis of unjust enrichment, which simply didn't exist as a body of a recognizable corpus of law on this side of the Atlantic until he and Robert Gough, who subsequently became a law lord, analyzed it in that groundbreaking book. Tony Jolovich supervised me for Tort. Winfield and Jolovich is still, I think, published. And I'll finally mention Elie Lauterpacht, who was an international lawyer, also a fellow of Trinity, a very distinguished international lawyer, founded the Lauterpacht Center here. He was the son of Sir Hersch Lauterpacht, who was, in the end, the UK judge at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. Have any of you read East West Street? Yes, well, you'll know all about Hersch Lauterpacht. It's a book well worth reading if you haven't read it. It's an astonishing story, really. These two great, Lemkin and Lauterpacht, these two great figures of public international law, both coming from Lvov in what is now the Ukraine. Touching on one thing, I was quite pleased that I took the option of jurisprudence in my third year. And the reason I was pleased to do that is that it introduced us, in a way that individual courses don't, to some very basic concepts in the law. For example, what is a person? What is property? And other such issues, as well as Hofeldian analyses and so on. And I'll come back to this in a different context, but I have found that really important, because occasionally these building blocks come into sharp focus. I mean, property now has come into very sharp focus because of crypto assets and the fact that crypto assets don't fit into recognizable categories of property, but clearly are property. So I just found that a helpful thing. The only other thing I'll say about my time at Cambridge was that in, in my second year, or maybe beginning of third year, I was in London, and I thought, well, I'll go and have a look at the Royal Courts of Justice in the Strand. I don't know if any of you have been to the Royal Courts of Justice. It's a magnificent building, absolutely amazing building. And it's where the High Court and the Court of Appeal of England and Wales are located. And I went in, and I thought, as every law student did at that time, well, I better find out what Lord Denning is doing. How many of you here know about Lord Denning? Everyone. Good. I'm really pleased to hear of that, because it's difficult to convey. He was an absolutely monumental figure at his time. He sort of bestrode not just the law, but somehow he had a presence and an influence beyond the law. And I think it's fair to say there's been no judge since Denning quite with the sort of influence that he had. The law lecturers always made fun of Denning. He was actually a brilliant lawyer, but he was certainly not above twisting the law to get to what he thought was the right result. Anyway, I found my way to his court, Court 4, and I stumbled in and sat down, and it became apparent that what I was listening to was an appeal by a man called, it was either Norris or Ross McWhirter, but anyway, the twins that started the Guinness Book of Records. And he was very opposed to the UK joining what was then the European Economic Community, or the Common Market, it was called. And he had brought proceedings for an injunction against the government to restrain it from signing the Treaty of Rome. This, of course, was legally a hopeless claim, because the courts do not have any jurisdiction to restrain the exercise of the royal prerogative in the conduct of foreign relations. And in any event, the treaty would be given effect by an act of parliament, and the courts couldn't interfere with that. But it was a wonderful hearing. McWhirter was very fluent, and Denning indulged him splendidly. There was a wonderful interchange where one of the judges he was sitting with teased McWhirter when he referred to the Bill of Rights, saying that there were academic articles which suggested that the Bill of Rights never formed part of English law. Denning would have none of it. No one in this court's going to say that the Bill of Rights isn't part of English law, he said. So, having left Cambridge, I did the bar finals, as they were called then. I was called to the bar in 1974 by the Inner Temple, although I, a few years later, joined Lincoln's Inn because my chambers were there, and that's really remained my inn since. I had decided by the time I left here that I was interested in doing company law, as has been mentioned. Why on earth was I interested in doing company law? Well, actually, it proved to be a good choice as far as I was concerned, because it had a good mix. There was plenty of law in it, both statutory law and case law, but it was highly practical. So I was constantly presented with practical problems which needed solving. It was a mixture of court work and advisory work, about 50-50, I would say. Most company law is done by solicitors. I mean, there are armies of solicitors in city firms who are devoted to corporate law in one form or another. The number of barristers specializing in the work is relatively small, and they are there either to conduct high-level corporate litigation or to provide sort of tie-breaking advice in cases where the solicitors on either side or even the partners in the same firm can't agree. And what I found about it, leaving perhaps the litigation side to one side for the moment, is that quite often advice would be sought, well, is it lawful for us to do this? And if you formed the view that it was not lawful, of course you said, but you then tried to find a way whereby they could achieve their result lawfully. And so that's the way I approached most things. And normally you could say, well, if you know, you can't do it that way, but have you thought about doing it this way? So it was very much, I felt, sort of law in action, in practice, practical application. The court work was fun as well. In the area of company law and insolvency, there's a lot of disputes between shareholders. Are any of you doing or have done company law as a course here? So a lot of unfair prejudice work, just and equitable winding up petitions, derivative actions, shareholder agreement disputes, or claims against directors brought either by the company or derivatively by shareholders or by liquidators or administrators. So there was quite a lot of that. And also insolvency produces cases in myriad areas of the law. As a judge, I was the assigned judge to deal with the insolvency of the T&N group, which won't mean anything to you, but it was called Turner & Newell, and it was one of the world's major manufacturers of asbestos products. That in turn gave rise, of course, to massive tort liabilities, particularly in the United States, but also here. I remember that the estimated value, if you like, of the tort claims in this country was something like £600 million. In the United States, it was something like $12 billion. I mean, just massive. But in the course of that, I had to get to know or be educated by counsel into the relevant law relating to that area of personal injuries and aspects of asbestos-related diseases. It's simply to illustrate that insolvency casts a very wide net in the type of work that it involves. I joined a set of chambers called Erskine Chambers, which was then, and I'm happy to say remains, probably the leading set of company law chambers. In many ways, law practice hasn't changed a huge amount, but in one respect, it has changed a huge amount. In those days, we relied on books. I mean, the internet didn't exist. And so we had law reports. So you had in your room bookshelves all the way around, and you had a set of law reports, which were quite valuable. I mean, you bought a set of law reports, and you could sell it. Unfortunately, the internet came along before it was my time to sell, and it became worthless. The only advantage of books over the internet was that not every case was available. So the editors of the law reports made their choices and reported only the cases that seemed to matter. So although there were a lot of other cases, they just disappeared from sight. The bane of modern practice is that there is this just vast universe of cases which people can get a bit bogged down in. Having said that, of course, it's incredibly convenient, and it enables research to be done incredibly quickly. I'm just going to mention two cases I was involved in at the bar. It could be others, but one of them, in 1986, an international organization where the members were states, set up by treaty, called the International Tin Council, went bust. And that led to a huge amount of litigation. I was instructed, I was still a junior counsel then, on behalf of the British government. But there were about 26 countries involved, and then groups of creditors that were owed huge amounts of money. Proceedings started in September 1986. They concluded in September 1989. It wasn't continuous, but I did at one point count up. And I was actually in court for 6 months out of that 3 years, and it was all law. We never got anywhere near the facts in any myriads of hearings. We ended up in the House of Lords in the summer of 1989. It's unbelievable to say, but the hearing lasted 6 weeks. And I believe that is the longest case ever in the front of the Judicial Committee of the House of Lords. It involved a wide range of issues of international law, company law, contract law, constitutional law, all sorts of areas. But, and I come back to my jurisprudence course here, at its heart was, what is the International Tin Council? Is it a person? Because if it's not a person, it doesn't owe anything. And if it doesn't owe anything, then its members do. So it was absolutely crucial from our point of view, acting for British governments and the other governments, to establish that the International Tin Council did have legal personality. But it was legal personality of a very peculiar kind. But it was a very, very interesting case. The other one I will just very briefly mention was arose out of the liquidation of a company called the Bank of Credit and Commercial International, BCCI, which went bust in 1992, was wound up by regulators around the world. It was a fraudulent enterprise. And it was really the first of what has become relatively common of sort of worldwide insolvencies. The liquidators brought many claims. My client was a Saudi citizen whose family owned the largest bank in Saudi Arabia. They had invested in BCCI. I think for a short while they had a holding of about 25%. And my client had become a director. He was sued for $10 billion. There was litigation in this country and in the United States. The US court stayed the US proceedings so that the proceedings here continued, but they were ultimately settled, I'm happy to say, for a figure a long, long way south of $10 billion. They raised questions of fiduciary duties, knowledge of other breaches of fiduciary duties, and so on. But it was an unusual case because it really involved a fair degree of Middle Eastern politics, Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi in particular, and other Gulf states. It was an interesting experience. As was mentioned, I became a judge in 2003 in the Chancery Division. For me, that meant a broader spread of work, but all within what you might call a sort of general business and property envelope, general commercial work, property, trusts, company law, insolvency, intellectual property, tax. It's worth pausing just for a moment to reflect a little on the differences between being a judge and being a practitioner. I think I didn't quite make the point, but implicitly I did, that the big difference between being a student and being a practitioner is that you're concerned with real cases, you're concerned with the facts of the case and applying the law to those facts and so on. And in many areas of the law, actually legal issues may not come into play very much. In other areas they do, in commercial law they do, company law they do, trusts and so on. But some areas it's much rarer for issues of law to arise. As a judge, a lot of your time is spent, as a first instance judge, a lot of your time is spent on analyzing the factual evidence and making findings of fact. I mean, that is the essential role of a first instance judge, because unless the judge makes a complete mess of it, appellate courts can't interfere. So the facts are really set by the trial judge, and any legal analysis will be on the basis of those facts. When I was a barrister, I thought that the really difficult part of a judge's job would be deciding legal issues, and the easy part would be making findings of fact. Completely wrong. It's the other way around. The law, I'm not saying that it's easy to make legal decisions, but you sort of know what you're doing. You may get it right, you may get it wrong. But making findings of fact is actually very difficult and requires a lot of analysis. I think as a barrister, you perhaps have a better just sense and feel as to whether your client is telling the truth or not. But the judge doesn't have that advantage. I think also, as a first instance judge, there's a very limited role for sort of public policy and legal philosophy and so on. Those are issues which emerge more perhaps at Court of Appeal and certainly Supreme Court level, but not really at first instance level. The first instance judge, High Court judge, is applying the law as it presently exists, either in the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court. But actually, there are quite a lot of issues arise where you do have to make the legal decision yourself because it's not covered by any appellate decision. So that is interesting. And the third point I'd like to stress, which is true of all levels of the court, is that judges are incredibly dependent on the submissions made by the advocates. It's the duty of the advocates to present the relevant law. So if there are decided cases and so on that are in point, certainly that are decisive, they must cite them. Judges are hearing hearing cases across a wide range of subject areas. And I mean, obviously, we can't have detailed knowledge of each of those areas. So the role played by the advocates, not only in representing their clients and doing the very best they can within the confines of professional duty, but also in assisting the court in educating the court in the relevant area, is really important. I remember when I was first appointed, and counsel would quite often know that particular area of chancery work had not been one I was very familiar with. They would say things like, "Your Lordship will recall that the law in this area is this." Of course, they knew damn well I didn't know it at all, but they were A, very helpful, and B, very polite about the way they did it. Then the Court of Appeal. I sat in the civil division of the Court of Appeal, not having been a criminal practitioner or criminal judge. I didn't sit in the criminal division, except as it happens in two cases which raise company law type issues. The big thing about the big difference in the Court of Appeal is, first of all, it's a huge spread of work across all areas of civil law. Suddenly, you feel like a student again. All these subjects you haven't really looked at for years, and some that you never looked at. So I'd never done any family law as a student or in practice. And there's quite a few family cases in the Court of Appeal. But don't worry, it's not just the amateurs who are hearing these cases. You'd always get some, at least one, maybe two members of the panel of three judges in the Court of Appeal who are familiar with that area of the law. And it works well because you get someone who isn't specialist in the area, who's able to sort of apply a more general focus and sometimes query. I mean, is it really, you say that's how it's always done, but is that really right? And those interventions or contributions are really important. Party can't go to the Court of Appeal without permission. Either the first instance judge can give permission or the Court of Appeal. The main test is whether there's a real prospect of success. If it's a second appeal, so it's been, let's say, in the county court, then the high court, then the Court of Appeal, a second appeal must raise a point of law. But if it's from the High Court, it needn't be a point of law, but it's difficult to appeal successfully on findings of fact. Then, as you've heard, I had this curious interval in my career when I retired in 2021. That's because I then reached the age of 70. and it was then the mandatory retirement age for judges. But the following year, in 2022, Parliament increased the retirement age back to what it had been 20 years earlier, of the retirement age being 75. And as you've heard, in October, I was appointed, of 2022, appointed to the Supreme Court. I count myself incredibly lucky, very privileged, to have had this opportunity, which was clearly not an opportunity I ever envisaged, and certainly not after I retired in June 2021. The Supreme Court, just a number of points to make. First of all, of course, it's the United Kingdom Supreme Court, whereas the High Court and the Court of Appeal are England and Wales. Scotland and Northern Ireland have their own judicial systems, their own high courts, their own courts of appeal. But we have take cases from throughout the United Kingdom. And to reflect that, of the 12 justices, by convention, two are from Scotland. That goes back a very long way. It may, I don't know when it started. It may really come from the Act of Union. Whether it goes back as far as that, I'm not sure, but certainly so long, I think, as there's been the Judicial Committee of the House of Lords, which was sometime in the 19th century, there were always two Scottish judges. And there's one from Northern Ireland. I'm not sure there always was one from Ireland, but certainly in the last 30, 40 years, there's always one from Northern Ireland as well. We do get issues from those countries. Northern Irish law is pretty similar to English law, but there is, just because of the conditions in Northern Ireland, its own history and so on, very sensitive issues can arise in appeals from Northern Ireland, including, just by way of example, the recent decision as to the place of religion in education. And given the background in Northern Ireland, you can immediately see that that's a potentially sensitive issue. I think that the Supreme Court were necessarily very conscious of the constitutional position of the courts. I mean, all courts have a particular place in the Constitution, but their daily work does not normally raise any issue in that respect. But I think my own experience is that is ever present, really, in the minds of the Supreme Court. And it is a constant feature of our work, I think, as to what the proper relationship is between the courts and Parliament and the government. And that relationship comes into play in a number of respects. First of all, and this is something I hope to touch on briefly, is statutory interpretation, trying to interpret what the purpose, what the meaning of acts of Parliament are, and secondary legislation. Secondly, the development of the common law. One is always asking, is this the development? It makes a lot of sense, but is it one we should be making, or is it one we should leave to Parliament? The more it raises controversial, or if it raises, I would say, controversial social issues, then it's for Parliament, not for the courts to make decisions in matters of social or economic controversy. Thirdly, in the area of human rights, that necessarily involves the court in seeking to achieve the proper balance between particular individual rights and the counterbalancing needs and rights of society at large. And that's an area where it's probably the area where the courts come in for the most criticism from those interested or involved in politics. Well, that's part of the territory. And fourthly, and relatedly, in the area of judicial review of government decisions and decisions of public authorities, In those areas, we have to have a particular regard for what is really the province of government or parliament. For example, national security or again social and economic policy is a matter for the government or parliament largely. There may be other areas where the courts are better equipped to involve themselves. These are all, I mean, I've just sketched areas, but I think it is a constant theme. And oddly, the geography emphasizes this, as I don't know if some of you will know, that the Supreme Court building is on Parliament Square. And if you come out of the Supreme Court, opposite you is Parliament. And to the left of you is the Treasury building, and then Whitehall down there. So we're actually there, where the three, what are said to be the three branches of government, the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary, are there on three sides of Parliament Square. The church is on the fourth with Westminster Abbey. What cases do we take? We take, as you probably know, a relatively small number of cases, on average something like 60 or 65 a year. We're entirely dependent on a losing party in the Court of Appeal or the equivalent in Scotland or Northern Ireland wanting to bring their case to us. We can't say to parties, that's a very important case, you must come to us. I was saying earlier that I quite often check on what the Court of Appeal has been deciding, and look at their judgments, and think, well, that would be a jolly interesting case for us to have. It never comes because, for whatever reason, the losing party doesn't want to come. So we're entirely dependent on what the customers want to bring us. And we then look at the applications for permission to appeal, and we apply a test that it's got to be an arguable point of law of general public importance. And that means that of general public importance means that it has a wider reach than the case in which it arises. So it's going to affect other cases. Maybe it's a standard form contract. Maybe it raises, although on a particular contract, it raises a general principle of contract law. It may be a negligence claim that raises a point of principle. It may be a tax case, which will have a wide impact on other cases. Similarly in public law areas. So when we're looking at applications, we're asking ourselves, first of all, well, you can do it whichever way round. I tend to say, well, is this a point of general public importance? I mean, if it's a point of construction of a tailor-made contract, the chances are it's not of general public importance, however arguable the point is. If it is of potentially general public importance, then I ask myself, well, is it arguable? So you've got to pass both tests before we give permission. We're not a court of error. That's to say, we're not there to correct errors which may have occurred in the individual case. That is the role of the Court of Appeal. The nature of our work will change depending over the years on the pressures that exist. So just to illustrate that, the introduction of the Human Rights Act 1998 introduced a whole new body of law into our domestic law, and how that was going to be assimilated and applied and developed as a matter of domestic English law was a whole new area. And it's not in the least surprising that in the years following the Act coming into force, there were a significant number of cases in the House of Lords, and then after 2009, in the Supreme Court. There are still, of course, cases, but there are far fewer than there used to be, because the thing has bedded down with the aid of numerous decisions of the House of Lords and the Supreme Court. We've had cases over a wide area. I was quickly... I'm conscious of time. I was quickly going to mention three areas. First of all, tort law. Have you all done tort or are all doing tort? Well, I don't know whether you're being plagued with these cases, but There's been a very rich seam of decisions of the Supreme Court in areas of tort law over the last 3 years, starting with Fearn and the Tate Gallery on nuisance, with the viewing gallery on the Tate Gallery overlooking the flats, and very different views being taken by the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal on that. Very interesting developments. Then BXB and the trustees of the Barry Congregation of Jehovah's Witnesses. This is a case where an elder of the Barry congregation raped one of his a member of the congregation at his home. And the issue was whether the Jehovah's Witnesses organization was vicariously liable for it. The decision in the end was on the facts of the case that the Jehovah's Witnesses were not vicariously liable. But I don't know whether you've looked at that case, but Lord Burroughs does what I think is a really magisterial analysis and study of the development of vicarious liability in this area, and demonstrates how originally vicarious liability was limited to liability for the acts of employees, and how it's been developed to cover, as it were, quasi-employees, people who are in a position similar to employees, but not actually employees. That, I think, is an interesting example of how the law develops to meet changing social needs, because it's really been driven by sex abuse cases, which, you know, never surface. It's not as if it wasn't happening. Of course it was happening, but it didn't surface in the way that it has done. And so the law really needed to change to accommodate this new, well, so far as the courts were concerned, the civil courts, this social problem. A case, I wasn't on any of those cases, but I was on Paul and Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust. This was a case that concerned the liability of tortfeasors to people who witness the death or serious injury of close relatives or close friends. And there had been the previous decisions where, you know, the terrible football catastrophe when a significant number of Liverpool fans were crushed to death, witnessed in some cases by members of their family, either who were in the stadium or were watching it on TV, some of whom suffered psychiatric injury, genuine personal injury, and were entitled to recover damages. The Paul case involved an extension of that so that it would cover this case where there was clinical negligence, either a failure to diagnose correctly or an operation conducted negligently, and some time later, weeks or months later, the patient died a horrible death, witnessed by members of their family, and could a member of the family, who as a result of witnessing the terrible death suffered psychiatric injury, recover? And we sat as a court of seven because of the importance of the case and the invitation to overrule earlier House of Lords authority, and we held that the tort principle should not be extended to cover that case. Perhaps an example of where, if there was to be intervention, it should be for Parliament, not for the courts. But we felt that was an extension of the common law that could not be justified. If you want a contrary view, then you read Lord Burroughs's dissenting judgment. And then in this context, I'll just mention a decision handed down on the 21st of January this year of Lewis Rannell and G4S Health Services. This was the claimant killed three people. He was prosecuted for their murder. He was found not guilty on grounds of insanity and is subject to a hospital order. Now, he sued various parties because they had, he said, not supervised him correctly, and if they had supervised him correctly, he wouldn't have killed these people, and he wouldn't now be detained in a criminal mental hospital. The Supreme Court dismissed his claims on grounds of illegality. The difficulty arose because previously these cases had involved a finding of guilt, either guilty of murder or guilty of manslaughter on grounds of diminished responsibility. Here he had been found not guilty. But it's a very interesting decision if you're looking at illegality, either in a tort context or indeed in a contract context. I'll mention, I went through the same analysis as I might have done there with cases in equity. How many of you are doing equity and trusts, or have done? Well, I'm sorry, we've made life much more difficult for you all. The only thing I will say from my point of view is that when I was here and doing equity, two of the areas which we seem to spend a lot of time on, quite rightly. One was Section 53(1)(c) of the Law of Property Act and the trio of cases of Gray, Oughtred, and Vandeville. There those three cases lay, decided in the 50s and 60s, until we had a case called Frenkel and Lamicro, where that section was center stage again, and we were asked to overrule Gray, but we declined that invitation. So that was very much, I mean, Section 53(1)(c) in my practicing career had cropped up a handful of times. I'm not sure it had ever cropped up as a judge. And here we are, I was sort of going back to what I had been learning here. But that wasn't the first time, because then we had Rukadza. And in Rukadza, we were asked to overrule Phipps and Boardman. Well, Phipps and Boardman had been decided about 2 or 3 years before I started here. So it was absolutely center stage in Gareth Jones's lectures. And take some, you know, 50 odd years later to be asked to look at it again and say whether it was right or not was very interesting, but we said it was right. So I apologize to those of you who are doing equity and those of you who will be doing equity. We've added a lot to your load. Professor Virgo appeared as counsel for the losing side, I think, in Rukadza. I just mentioned that. That doesn't. Counsel are there to argue their client's case. They're not there to say what they think is right or wrong. And that's a very important principle. Finally, in this, I just wanted to mention the statutory interpretation, because a lot of our work does involve statutory interpretation. It's not, I think, taught, correct me if I'm wrong, not taught as a subject here. And it might not be an easy one to teach at university, but it in quite a lot of the law, it's very important, and we get a lot of it. I mean, one of my colleagues has estimated that 2/3 of the cases he's been in the Supreme Court have raised issues of statutory interpretation. And the interesting thing is that they're often interpreting ordinary English words. We had a case yesterday and the day before, it was a tax case, and it was about wind farms in the North Sea and the Irish Sea. And the question was whether the wind farm companies could get allowances for, quote, expenditure on the provision of plant and machinery. And it's very difficult. But, I mean, they're ordinary English words. Last week, we had 2 days in another tax case on what is meant by, quote, significant influence on the affairs of a partnership. Well, significant influence is, I mean, that's just a matter of judgment on the facts, but what are the affairs of the partnership? And again, just pretty straightforward English words, but you have to look at it in the context and as it may apply in other cases, in other statutes, have there been cases on it, really brings out all the principles of statutory construction. I can't tell you what the answers in either case. Watch this space. They'll be coming out in the following months. Let me just mention two other things. Sorry, I've gone on too long. First of all, the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council is something that you probably barely know about. But we sit also as members of that Judicial Committee. It probably takes up something between a third and 40% of our time. We take appeals from about 30 overseas jurisdictions, some of them as close as the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man, many of them in the Bermuda and then in the Caribbean, the Bahamas, Cayman Islands, British Virgin Islands, Trinidad and Tobago, Jamaica, and also Mauritius. A wide range of cases. We're sitting as the Supreme Court of that country. We're not sitting as the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom. So we have, we've got an appeal from Jamaica. We have the Jamaican flag behind us. We get a wide range of cases, criminal appeals. Most of these countries and territories have constitutions, written constitutions. So we get constitutional issues. Employment, and then from the offshore financial centres, Channel Islands, Bermuda, Cayman, British Virgin Islands, and sometimes other jurisdictions, we get really important cases in the field of trusts, company law, and insolvency. Trusts, because these days, most of the major trust litigation does not occur in this country. It occurs in those jurisdictions, and some of them come on appeal to us in the Privy Council, and are really important cases. Company law, there are a lot of companies incorporated, in particular in the Cayman Islands, and in the BVI, also in Bermuda, which have nothing to do with those territories at all, particularly Chinese companies. So I look back, I've sat on, I should think, about 8 company law appeals over the last 3 years in the Privy Council, and virtually all of them, the underlying businesses are in China. The reason originally, I think, why these jurisdictions have been used is because they have outside investors outside of China. So they want a neutral, as it were, jurisdiction. But some of the cases, all the shareholders have been Chinese. So it's been quite interesting to do that. But they raise really interesting points of company law. So I'll wrap up now just with 2 final comments. First of all, some of your colleagues will be reading law not with a view to becoming lawyers at all. You've got a clear idea what you want to do after you leave university, and you don't want to practice law, but you want to have read law. And that's good, and that's fine. But, I mean, some of you, many of you probably, are thinking you do want to become practicing lawyers, and some of you may be just undecided. To those who are undecided, my advice will be get qualified, either as a solicitor or as a barrister, for 2 reasons. First of all, it'll keep your options open. So if you decide you do want to be a practicing lawyer, then you're equipped to do so. But secondly, having that professional qualification cannot be anything other than a help in the jobs market. So it will be a significant addition to your CV. The only other point I wanted to make is this, that we in the Supreme Court have what we call judicial assistants. These are bright lawyers like you, who are with us for a year. They work closely with us. There are 12 of them. Each of us has a judicial assistant. They will either have qualified and have a year that they want to fill, either qualified as solicitors or barristers, or they may be solicitors transferring to be barristers, or they may have done significant postgraduate work as well. It's a really fantastic thing to do. I mean, the JAs, as we call them, I mean, they love it. I mean, they have a great year. They're working very closely with us. We're discussing RK. They do research for us. They prepare memos on permission to appeal applications and appeals. They're closely involved in our work. And they all get to know each other very well. And we have events every couple of years where all the sort of previous JAs are invited, and an awful lot come and like to see the people they were with. So if you, you know, just think about it, if particularly if you, you know, to sort of build into what you might be doing, or if you find that there's a year, because quite often people find there's a year they've, let's say, qualify, they've done their bar qualifications, but before pupillage starts, they've got a year to fill. Or if, I mean, it can arise in lots of different ways. But it's a really, really worthwhile thing to do. High quality work, very interesting, right at the heart of the Supreme Court's work. And something which I think they enjoy, and they make, you know, a great network of friends who will keep them, with whom most of them will keep in touch, I suspect, throughout their working lives. Well, I'm sorry, I've overrun my time terribly. It's now 6 o'clock. But please, anyone who wants to ask a question, I retain the privilege to say I won't answer it.